Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Wilson Contreras slams one deep left center. It's a goner. The Cardinals are down by two again, as Contreras, who struck out the first two times, just hit one out, his 17th home run of the year and his 67th RBI.
Yo, Paulie!
Paulie's a great name.
Yo, Paulie!
What'd you do for Paulie? Anything?
Me, Paulie! I was responsible!
Paulie, we're here because of you.
Well, Cardinals in Florida, and they just won 2 of 3 from the Marlins. They're going to play Tampa Bay starting tonight. This is one of those weirdo series where there is a game tonight, a game tomorrow, and then they're off Saturday.
So why are they doing
that? There's a football game Saturday.
Oh.
I think the Bucks play or something.
But
I don't know.
It's preseason.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But still, there's a game. So there's no game on Saturday, which is crazy because it's like the perfect day of the week to have a baseball game. Mm-hmm. So no game Saturday, then they'll play Sunday. We are joined now by Matt Paulie, the host of Sports Open Line, Redbird Rush Hour, and there'll be about 40 minutes of Redbird Rush Hour today, starting at 5 o'clock and Cardinals pre and post. Matt Paulie, welcome back to St. Louis.
Thank you. Just to put a little bit more on that, so they're playing in a minor league stadium this year because the roof got ripped off of Tropicana Field.
Right.
And I believe the minor league stadium is in very close proximity to where the Buccaneers play. Mm-hmm. So from a logistics standpoint, I don't think they can pull off both events at the same
time. Do you know what the capacity is for that stadium that Tampa Bay's playing in right now?
I can look it up, but I would guess it's like 8,000. That's what most places like that are.
Yeah, it's pretty small. And did they not?
Will they count that then? You know how we were talking about Cardinals attendance and how it's way down,
mm-hmm.
and how the Colorado Rockies are outdrawing.
It's just,
this can't count.
It's 11,000, by the way. It's 11,000.
Okay.
Yes, but it does. That's what the attendance is. It counts against them. So if they sell out, their attendance is 11,000.
That was one of the problems because the way players get paid in the postseason is playoff shares.
Right.
You don't get like an extended salary because your season gets extended. The only way players get money in the playoffs is by playoff shares. Playoff shares is connected to attendance and ticket revenue. Mm. So there was a lot of discussion about both the A's and the Rays, that if they were to get into the postseason, would they try to put those games in different venues?
But they decided not to, right?
They decided not to.
Yeah, they were going to play in that minor league park.
Yep. It doesn't look likely they'll make the postseason, but if they were to, those players will get paid basically less than players for other teams will get paid.
Honestly, wouldn't that not be something if you've got this stadium that seats 11,000 people and that is a playoff stadium? You've got series. You've got at least a couple of games happening.
So I know we were...
That would just have been nuts.
Not to stick too long on the attendance topic, but I really do believe what I said earlier this week, which I think Ronge agrees with me, that you can complain or name all the reasons why Cardinals fans aren't showing up like they usually do this season. You can say crime. They don't want to drive downtown. Parking's too expensive. And I say winning erases all of those excuses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fans will show up when the team is winning, but I guess the caveat would be, except for in Florida, why don't fans show up for the Rays?
Well, Matt, you've been down there to Tampa. That's a really crappy ballpark to get to. It's just not a great location.
Yeah, it's a bad location. And they're going to get a new ballpark, I think, at some point when this new ownership group comes in. That's going to get a little bit, they're going to play better with local government officials than the current group. Yeah, it's but it's always been that way. I'm not convinced that you're ever going to get huge crowds in Tampa or Miami for Major League Baseball. That's just, it's kind of the way things are, unfortunately, down there, even when they're winning. And you know, I think when you're talking about postseason and things like that, obviously, they always had really great crowds. But just for an average Tuesday night game, I don't think it really matters how good they are. Now, on the other side of it, you go look at like a place like Toronto, where this year they're really good, but historically they have not been especially good. That place rocks and rolls every single night, whether the team's good or bad. Colorado's another spot. They are a terrible baseball team, but people show up to Coors Field. It's not because of baseball. Like, I thought it was – I got frustrated the other day when people said, oh, my gosh, the Cardinals' attendance is worse than the Rockies. How embarrassing is that? Well, if you understood what's going on in Colorado, you would understand that what you're paying a cover charge to go to a bar. And that's what mm-hmm. it is at Coors Field. People don't show up to Coors Field for the baseball. People show up for the environment, the view. They blew out the entire upper right field section a few years back and put in like a party club, party deck up there where you can't even see the field. It's just a big bar. So that's why people go. But there are ways to get people into ballparks, even when the team's not winning. I don't know if in St. Louis that's ever going to be possible mm-hmm. because Cardinals baseball and winning Cardinals baseball is so important to people in the city.
So that is a they've got the Bud Terrace, which has been up yeah. there for several years now. So it's a similar kind of thing, but you could still see the game from up there, but it's a place to go and hang out. You know, it's not like sitting in your seats. I think it is a different market in that way. Matt, don't you? Then, and I don't think it's just about, well, we demand winning. I just, my impression is there are a few more families that go to Cardinals games. You've got people who are traveling from other cities coming into town, and they are more likely to go if the team is good than they are to, you know, come from Arkansas if the team's not very good. So because they rely on the out-of-towners so much, doesn't that affect, you know, the way they would be able to attract fans? Like, would you be able to attract them if you said, we're just turning Busch Stadium into a big bar now?
There'd be a certain demographic that would come in, but I think your core customer, no. And you mentioned the outer markets. There's two things. A, you think about the groups and, you know, how many church groups, how many Kiwanis clubs, things like that, maybe not even in the St. Louis area, who make an annual trip into St. Louis, have maybe scrapped it this year. That's one part of it. And then, yeah, just the fact that the Cardinal Nation footprint does expand, obviously, to Oklahoma and Arkansas and Iowa and all these places where if the excitement and fervor for the team is not what it normally is, those people might not make the decision to drive 3, 4, 5, 6 hours into St. Louis multiple times a summer.
All right, so this trip is happening. The Florida trip continues. They took 2 of 3 from Miami. And at this point of the year, Matt, how much are you concerned with the outcome of games?
I mean, I want them to win.
I asked the question. I mean, it's not a stupid question. It's because this is probably not going to be a playoff team, right? And unless they go on some incredible run, and I think we're looking toward the future. So how important are the outcomes to you?
Okay, I'll just say, like, my take on your question, tell me if you're right, but if you're giving young players a chance to develop but you're losing games versus throwing in the veterans and able to snag a few games, are you willing to lose games to give rookies and young guys more reps?
Yes, without a doubt. I'm definitely willing to do that. I also think there's value in playing games. Like right now, they're 5 games out of a playoff spot. If they're 3 games out, I think it feels a little bit different. They're 2 games under 500.
Sure.
If they're 1 game over 500 and 3 games out of a playoff spot, our conversation is probably like, well, that door is still like slightly ajar. I would like to at least get to that slightly ajar point once again, where they're playing games that really still have some meaning and young guys get the opportunity to just experience that. The runway thing and the finding out about that guys thing, there's not a lot of season left. What are we really going to learn about anybody between now and the end of the season? I'm not trying to say that it's meaningless or anything like that. It's just, I don't know how much value there is at this point moving forward in all that stuff, but I don't. At the same time, it's not like it's a 6 weeks without value. And I know I'm kind of talking out both sides of my mouth here.
It's really interesting you say that because, you know, September, when that month rolls around, there are the September call-ups and teams can bring up guys from the minor leagues and they expand the rosters. So when they do that, typically, you know, we're all going to want to see JJ Weatherholt. I don't know if we're going to see him, but we'd like to get a taste of that. So I think there's a lot of hope from Cardinals fans that he makes his way up to the club at some point before the year is over. So, I mean, you don't think there's a ton of value in that, or is there a little bit of value in bringing up a guy, letting him have a taste of the big leagues, even if it's only for 4 weeks?
Yeah, I think there's definitely value in that. I don't think they're going to call up JJ Weatherholt, and I think you can make a legit argument for both, speaking of talking on both sides of my mouth. Like one, the argument for is it's the Mason Winn argument. How much value did he get from having that final month of the season a couple years ago where he knew who he was going to be moving forward and knew what the big leagues was going to be and all that sort of stuff. So 100% value. Now, John Mozeliak has talked a lot lately about a couple things when it comes to that. One of them is the 40-man spots, and one of them is the service times thing. So from the fact that a lot of these guys, like a Quinn Matthews and like a J.J. Weatherholt, are not at a point right now where they have to be added to the roster, the 40-man roster this offseason, not putting them on the 40-man roster creates more flexibility for Heim Bloom. And I think that's a very legitimate argument to be made, that you, as Heim Bloom comes into his first season totally operating the big league roster, having as many 40-man spots available for him to do as much as he wants, I think there's a ton of value in that, and probably that outweighs the value of J.J. Weatherholt coming up for a final month. Now, something else that Mo has talked about a little bit, and I just kind of heard the things secondhand. I didn't hear, I was out of town, so I didn't hear the conversation that he had with Tom on Sunday morning, but I've seen some stuff, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe at this point he talked a little bit about the service time stuff, and that's where I would push back, because there's not a whole lot of difference in bringing a guy up for the final months of the season and having a guy on the opening day roster when it comes to service time. Now, if they're planning on stashing J.J. Weatherholt to AAA for the first month of the season next year to get another year of club control on him, that's a totally different conversation. But I don't get the sense that I get the sense that Weatherholt's going to be competing for a big league job. So if it's a service time thing, that's where I would probably push back a little bit.
All right, Matt, before we let you go, I know you said that, you know, Tampa Bay fans, hard to show up because they got to drive so much. How was it for you driving 13 hours with a 6-year-old and a 14-month-old twice in 4 days?
Yeah.
13 hours.
Yeah, it was a challenge. We unfortunately had a death in the family on my wife's side, so we had to get to Colorado Springs for a funeral over the last couple days. And my oldest, the 6-year-old, she's done that drive, and she's traveled a lot in her life. Our youngest has never traveled, and she is a squirmy little thing, and she was not having it. And of the 13 hours on the way out there, she probably screamed/cried for a good 12 hours of it.
Oh, no!
On the way back, she was a little bit better. She got a nap in yesterday when we were driving back. So the return trip was not as bad, but the going there was pretty terrible.
Matt,
pretty terrible.
You can plead the fifth. Was Benadryl involved at all?
It was not. It maybe should have been, but that I don't know if it would have worked. She was on one yesterday.
She was on one. Yeah, it's not a magic drug. I mean, it's just it takes the edge off, you know. But
yeah. We did. She took it to a new level after we crossed the Colorado border, and she was holding her ears. So we started to think she was probably being affected by the altitude as we were going up to, you know, close to 6,000 feet.
So that's the thing. So you don't realize that no. Western Kansas is like 4,000 feet.
Yeah. So we gave her Tylenol yesterday before the drive. That way, if she had ear issues, maybe that would be a little bit better. So maybe that went into it. But again, the first 8 hours of that drive, you're at sea level, so that wasn't most of the problem.
Have you considered asking her to please calm down a bit, because it's not, it's just not a logical thing to do, to scream and cry and make a bunch of noise when mom and dad are trying to relax?
I'm pretty good at like just tuning it out. I love my wife. That is not her strong. She has a lot of things she's good at. I've got a lot of things I'm good at. Mm-hmm. One of the things she is not as good at is being able to just, you know, because she's a mom. Moms react to kids crying more than dads do. It's an obvious. That's mom should be that way. But yeah, she did not. I think she had a harder time with it than I did.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's a rough 4 days, Matt, kind of all the way around.
Mom was like, she was probably going through all the permutations. What if we just left her here?
I know you guys have a guy get out real quick. Did you know that because it was a military, it was a funeral with somebody who served in the military, and they always do the military honors, which if you've been in one of those, that gets me every single time. But now the bugle that they play taps isn't a real bugle. It's they press a button while they have it up to their mouth or whatever, and it plays a recording of it.
What?
I don't know what you're...
Why?
That sounds made
up.
It's
not that long of a song.
No, it is not. And I'm sure there are times where they still use the real one, but that's an option. So when the two military folks came in, the person put it up and pressed a button, and that's when taps played.
What is the limp lip sinking term for bugle playing? That doesn't seem right.
You can make
right
it up right now. I know.
Well,
I saw
I'm
that.
I'm thinking
like,
of
what is
really
going
isn't
on?
That great right. of a term, honestly.
There is a thing called a taps bugle. It's an electronic self playing taps bugle that you buy. And
clearly they have a government contract.
And they're about $1,200.
Whoa.
Wow. Your tax dollars at work.
Why would you not just learn to play
it's like 10
that's
notes.
What I was thinking. It's the army. You can tell people to do things. Maybe, you go to music class.
You know what, maybe they just don't have enough people for all the funerals to do this.
Maybe.
That's a $1,200 bugle. Damn. Okay.
I don't even know what
I never knew about
for
that
bugles,
yep.
though.
I just looked it up. It's a real thing.
I'm gonna look at a regular bugle.
It's called
Matt,
the taps
is very
bugle
interesting. This is as interesting as my fact that there are only two escalators in Wyoming.
Thanks, Matt Pauly.
You bet.
Yo, Pauly, your sister's with me. I'll call you back later. See ya.
Redbird Rush Hour at 5 o'clock with Matt and Kevin Wheeler. Then the pregame show at 5:40. 6:35 first pitch, Cardinals and Rays from Tampa Bay. And we got the Gas House Gang, Bernie Miklas and me. That'll happen at 12 o'clock. We're going to talk to Babe Ruth's grandson on the show. Yeah. So stick around. Chris and Amy on KMOX.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Chris Ranji, Amy Mark scores with you. And hey, I wanted to follow up what Matt Pauly said. He went to a funeral, a family member who got military honors, and he talked about this automatic bugle. It's a taps bugle that plays taps electronically.
Yeah.
So
costs like $1,200.
It's really expensive. It's actually a really brilliant invention because 1,800 veterans who are entitled to military honors at their funeral die every day. 1,800
so
a day.
There's just way there are enough bugle players to accommodate all that. So that does make a lot of sense.
It's actually a really amazing tribute, an invention.
A text message says that along with that bit of information that Matt brought us, you mentioned that there are two escalators in Wyoming.
Well, yeah.
And a texter says, we are so glad you got that Wyoming tidbit in, Amy.
So, listen.
When were you going to use this?
Texter. Well, I was going to use it as my second, did you see this?
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of paused awkwardly, and I was like, is that your story? And you said, yeah. And then you just closed out the segment.
Well, we had
And I didn't get to tell my Wyoming fact.
It was time to go.
Well, there's two escalators in Wyoming. Do you think the Cheneys have ridden on both of them?
Liz
and her dad.
What if that's the thing to do in Wyoming? If you want to do something indoors, you have to go find the escalators.
Listen, I went to Wyoming. Not a lot of escalators. I think the airport is one level. Listen, I don't know if you can join
the airport.
Yeah.
There's one.
Well, in Jackson Hole. Okay. I don't know if you can join an airport, like a country club, but I would join the Jackson Hole Airport. It's the nicest, fanciest place I've ever been.
Which is nicer, Jackson Hole or Terminal 2 at Lambert?
It is a toss-up, but because of the Tetons, I'm giving it to Jackson Hole. The view from the airport, Ranch, I would join a membership to the Jackson Hole Airport so I could just sit there and look at the view and drink a soda. They should sell memberships to the airport.
There's a security concern with that.
Well, that's why you have to buy a membership. Yeah. You get TSA PreCheck. You have to go through security every time.
I would do it. If it's as pretty as you say.
That could help all of the people really struggling in Jackson Hole.
I'm sure they're having a tough time there.
Yeah.
We mentioned the state of Texas, which has voted to redistrict, and that means that the GOP could be gaining some congressional seats. The state of Missouri, well, considering it, but they have not decided to do it. Major Garrett, chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, he will join us next on KMOX.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Chris and Amy on KMOX. Every Thursday, just after 10:30, we talk to Major Garrett, the chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, and he is the host of The Takeout on CBS News 24/7. You can watch that or listen to it wherever you get your podcasts. It is really good, and Major Garrett is with us on KMOX. Good morning, Major.
Good morning. Thank you for that deep Led Zeppelin cut, The Ocean. Off of Houses of the Holy. That's great. Thank you.
That is our intrepid producer, Matt Pajeski, who is 26 years old.
I was deathly afraid, Matt, they were going to make you play that other song we talked about last week.
No, that won't happen.
The worst song ever.
Yeah.
The worst song ever recorded.
Debbie Boone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You light up my life.
Yeah.
Unquestionably the worst song ever recorded.
Well,
it was so funny how quickly I said, Major, what's the worst song ever? And I didn't even get the sentence out.
Yeah.
You go, Debbie Boone, you light up my life. Like, wow. Okay.
It was ready like to
you had
go.
Been, yeah. Like you had been wanting to vent about it for years.
For years.
Thank God somebody finally asked.
Exactly.
All this crap going on in Washington, but this song, I can't tolerate it.
I can finally open my spleen.
The quickest answer you've ever given. He was ready to go.
Major, I know we talked about the redistricting in Texas and the Democrats who were trying to prevent the vote and they fled the state, finally came back. And, you know, it's happening now. I don't think that we were under any illusion it was going to be prevented. So now that it is a reality, what happens next?
So it's a traveling roadshow now. The traveling redistricting roadshow. Coming to a state near you, or maybe the state that you live in. Missouri might even be touched by it. Certainly Indiana's thinking about it. It's now in California, maybe in New York. Other parts of the country are going to re-examine their district lines in order to try to offset what the president ordered Texas to do. It was never going to be blocked. It could only be delayed. And what House Democrats in Texas hope to do by fleeing the state, denying a quorum, and holding this in abeyance for some short period of time was to make it a national conversation, which they have succeeded in doing. They knew they could never stop it in Texas. The numbers were always against them and always would ultimately be against them. Their gambit was stop it while we can, try to elevate this to a national conversation, provoke California to get involved, and maybe other states as well. That has set off a sort of ricochet effect around the country where red states are looking at their maps, blue states are going to look at their maps, and we may have a lot of redrawing going on over the summer and fall. California's next.
Yeah, and Major, I was thinking, haven't we mandered all the Jerrys that we can? I mean, in some states, it's like Illinois, all the Jerrys have been mandered,
it feels like.
How far are we from being gerrymandered to the point that there's no next move?
Well, so it's a good point, Amy. About 40 districts House districts across the country are what professionals regard as competitive, meaning they're within 7 to 5 points. Most others are not. So a lot of the partisan advantage, reflecting the partisan divisions in the country, have sort of been squeezed out of the congressional maps. That's only happened in Texas. They didn't think that they were off base when they agreed on their congressional maps and said that they were racially consistent with the law and everything was fine. That's what Texas Republicans said a year ago about their map. But then President Trump said, no, I want 5 more districts as a hedge against possible losses elsewhere in the midterms in 2026. And Texas Republicans said, yes, sir, I guess our maps are flawed. They didn't see any flaws before. So if you really pressurize your congressional maps, you might be able to extract a few more seats for your party. There is, however, a danger in that. Every time you do that, you redraw the lines to make districts theoretically competitive for your party, Democrat or Republican, you make them a little bit more narrow in their margin of voter alignment, which means if there's a wave election, and 2026 could be, even that retooling might not be enough to withstand a wave. And that's happened in previous mid-session redistricting. Maps have been redrawn. They think it's a hedge against losses. The wave's too big. It doesn't matter at all. So the larger conversation about Medicaid, the big, beautiful bill, what Trump is doing with law enforcement, immigration, the economy, inflation, all those things, in the end, net-net, are going to be more important than these redrawn lines. But in the interim, everyone wants to take whatever partisan advantage they can find and extract as a hedge against the future.
So when this gerrymandering conversation happens, it's always like, well, Republicans do it. Yeah, but Democrats do it too. But correct me if I'm wrong on the history here, but wasn't it just a few years ago in that John Lewis Act that there was an anti-gerrymandering, a big part of that bill was that, and it was killed on the Senate floor. So,
yeah.
So Democrats did try to pass something here, did they not, to
get rid of gerrymandering? There were a lot of other flaws with that legislation,
sure.
And that's why it never had a chance of passing. And in that conversation, Democrats were pressuring Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema of Arizona, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kristen Sinema of Arizona, to give up the filibuster and kill it and just pass it by simple majority vote, and they wouldn't do that. Because the Democrats wanted so much more partisan advantage with that legislation, and it was flawed in a lot of different ways. So the redistricting is classic in the sense that where you currently stand and what you currently believe in and advocate for is not necessarily what you advocated for 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. There was a movement in this country, California, very much a part of it, was to try to depoliticize this as much as possible. To have an independent redistricting commission where you have outside advisors, legal experts, and you try to draw the lines so they are geographically coherent. They are coherent in terms of representation. So you don't have districts that run in super long, super thin dimensionality or unnecessarily wide or do that whole salamander thing, which is how we got the term in the first place for gerrymander. And that's been a movement, a kind of reformist movement. California was very proud of it. Lots of other states have done that. And that does take some of the harshest partisanship out of this process. But that's now being completely bowled over by the intensifying politics of if you do it, we're going to do it, and it's just a ping pong back and forth. So that effort to depoliticize or at least take some of the harsh partisanship out of it is now falling by the wayside, and partisans are, again, exerting undue influence over another part of American political life.
Can you ever see anytime soon there being an actual real substantive push to do something about this so it isn't politicized?
So there's one step that we had Kevin Kiley on the takeout last week. He's a congressman from Northern California. He set up legislation to basically have the Congress establish a federal prohibition against mid-session redistricting. Just do it after the census, as we have historically done. And those lines, as long as they withstand court interpretation after they're drawn after the census, are the lines for the next decade. Just do it that way. To get out of this process of relooking at your maps just because the political winds have shifted in an unfavorable way. whether or not he gets that out of committee, whether or not Mike Johnson puts that on the floor, whether or not the White House would support that, very unlikely. But it's a legislative conversation worth having, because voters are the ones who sort of get lost in this whole partisan fistfight. Because one of the things that people want to know is who their representative is. And they'd like to pick their representative, not have the representative pick their voters, as the cliche goes, which is what's going on now. So that's a conversation that can exist in Washington. Why don't we just do this once after the census, as our nation historically has, and leave the lines alone? That's one way to approach this. Whether that gets any traction or not, I'm not quite sure.
Major, one of the presidential appointments that had that saw hesitation from both the Democrats and more conservative members of the government was the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. Of course, there are so many headlines, and the president himself commands a lot of those headlines that I feel like we haven't seen her in the news that much, or at least I haven't, but yesterday, earlier this week, she decided to trim her staff, the entire office, by 40%, which is it's a big chunk of the office. Is this, what do you make of this move? Significant or just a bit of a bluster?
Probably long overdue. I've done a fair amount of reading about the Director of National Intelligence and the bureaucracy that is built up around it. And that office was created by Congress after 9/11. Why? Because there was a rearview mirror assessment that the intelligence community was not collaborating enough, that information was too siloed in each individual agency, and nobody knew or could see the big picture. So it was decided, as many things were after 9/11, through the rearview mirror of what happened, what was missed, why did 9/11 occur, we need better coordination. So we need a small office, that was the original construct, a small office to get all of these intelligence reports and then distribute them across the community. A small office, that was the original intent. The Director of National Intelligence and the bureaucracy around it has grown exponentially every year. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's in the tens of thousands of people. And lots of think tanks on the left and the right have said, this is absurd. This has nothing to do with the original congressional intent. It doesn't help. There's been vast mission creep. People there who have jobs, get paid a lot of money, don't even know what they're doing or what the mission is or their purpose. So I believe that the Director of National Intelligence and the bureaucracy has been ripe intellectually as a policy matter. Forget the politics, for cutting back dramatically. And the Biden administration never did it. The Obama administration never did it. Bush administration never did it. Now the Trump administration is. That may be more political than policy. There may be some retribution in there. I don't know, but it could definitely stand to be smaller.
So when we talked last week, we discussed the National Guard being deployed in Washington, D.C., because I believe you called it a war zone, and more states are sending National Guard troops to D.C. So this is, you know, it's not settled down any. What's it like there now? I mean, how is this going over? I know the locals aren't happy about it.
No, the locals are not happy about it. And there is in any society, there's always a give and take between security and intimidation, and a sense that you're just menaced, that there's just people around all over the place and nothing's disrupted, nothing is unsafe. Why are big armored vehicles rolling down my streets? That's the kind of conversation that's happening in every ward of Washington, D.C. And the National Guard forces still don't know exactly what they're doing. They don't have arrest powers. They are currently not yet armed, though they might be. The arrival of the other National Guard forces from other states, I talked to Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, for the Takeout about this earlier this week. And the whole hour-long interview is available on our YouTube page and our podcast platform. It's very, very interesting. We touch a lot of things. But he said, look, is there a crime problem in the District of Columbia? Yes. Should the federal government, because Washington, D.C. is a federal district, apply political pressure to get them to do a better job? Yes. Can it and should it offer some reinforcements to help in specific instances? Sure. But if you start deploying the National Guard, and moreover, governors from red states who just want to perform and please President Trump, his words, not mine, sending their National Guard forces, where does it end? Where does this philosophical idea that I think there's a problem in some local government and I'm going to solve it at the federal government end? Tom Tillis's point was it never ends. It's a slippery slope, and the federal government starts getting in everybody's business and starts militarizing the streets and disrupting things that have a better way to be solved. I think that's an important conversation to have in Washington. It certainly could be what Congress considers, because the president's powers, as so asserted, only last 30 days. To assert them again, he has to get Congress's approval, which means people are going to have to debate this, and they're going to debate it when they get back here in September.
Major, you mentioned the takeout earlier. Is that your most recent takeout, or you have another one ready?
No. So, and this is part of the evolving conversation for the show, because for 8 years, the takeout was a once-a-week event. Now it's 5 nights.
Yep.
Okay? So it's a 5-night-a-week show, and what you see on the show is the TV part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a whole other podcast life of the show. So we put parts of the Tom Tillis interview on the show last night, 4 different clips. But as I told the audience, that isn't even 25% of our conversation. So the full conversation, unedited as always, that's my promise, always has been to my audience, I don't get in the way. Everything that is said, you get to see and evaluate on your terms, not mine. That's on the YouTube page. It's on all the podcast platforms. And it's supplementary to the show. The show is always on the podcast of the Showcast, but every long-form interview we do, we add it to the feed so you can listen to it, or you can watch it on YouTube whenever you want to.
Amy and I don't edit our podcasts either, except for the parts we screw up.
Yeah, we only take out where we sound bad. Yeah.
So just as a teaser.
Yeah.
So we had lunch in Cornelius, North Carolina, at a very nice restaurant near Lake Norman, just outside of Charlotte. And the entree for both Tom Tillis and I was barbecue chicken and collard greens. I'm talking to Tillis. He's cutting up his chicken. I start to cut up my chicken, but I have my knife upside down.
Okay?
So Tillis, seeing a big fat opening, says, you know, that'd work better if you used the serrated edge. And I said, every senator I've ever met always wants a cheap shot. You're just a cheap shot artist like every other senator. And he says, no, you reporters are full of cheap shots. Anyway.
That's really good.
It's fun. It's right in the middle of the conversation.
That's awesome.
And that's what I try to do.
That's great.
I try to make a conversation that's about politics and serious things, but always leaves room for something a little on the lighter side, and him hassling me about my corn knife skills is probably...
I love it, because a lot of the podcasts, about 50 minutes, maybe give or take. This one's a bit longer, just over an hour.
And no breaks.
Awesome.
One of the great things about the new format is we don't have to drop it in for radio shows like we did for so long, so it's a continuous conversation.
Are you watching us on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter? If you're not, you can.
If you are, I'm glad you're here.
We're glad you're here.
Amy Marks Kors and Chris Ronji.
Hey, guess what we're doing later today?
Giving away Blues tickets?
Yeah, in the next hour. You got to keep listening. Not now. Don't call now. Put the phone down.
Yeah, you dingus. It's too early for this.
Too early, but we are giving away tickets, and they're not just tickets.
What are they, Amy?
Home opener, season opener.
Tell them, Amy.
To the Minnesota Wild.
Tell them, Amy.
Against the Minnesota Wild on October 9th, your St. Louis Blues, who have a huge chip on their shoulder.
Huge chip. We are going to do that, and then tomorrow also. So if you miss out today, you try and you lose, which you're probably going to.
Yeah.
So be prepared for that. And if it doesn't happen for you today, it could still happen for
tomorrow.
You tomorrow.
Yeah. You're probably going to lose tomorrow, to be honest.
So Amy imparted to us a bit of wisdom about the state of Wyoming, that there are only 2 escalators in the entire state.
Yeah.
Which does stand a reason. And Ian is watching us on YouTube and says, growing up in Montana, we had 2 escalators in the state in the 90s, and it was legitimately something I rode for fun.
I love it. I love it.
So if there are, I wonder how many are in Montana now? If there were 2 in the 90s, there have to be
more.
Like 8.
Okay, here's a question about Montana. Here's why I'm not sure if I believe there are only 2 escalators. Well... in the state of Wyoming, because here's what I was thinking. There's some pretty fancy homes in Wyoming, but I bet they have elevators, not escalators.
Yeah.
I think you put elevators in homes, not escalators.
I've never seen an escalator in a house.
Why? But maybe it's time to start.
There would just be no purpose whatsoever for an escalator in a house.
Yes, there would be, because it's stairs. Because, like, right now you have to have an elevator and stairs. But if you have an escalator, it's an elevator and stairs all in one. And if there's a fire, you can still take the escalator.
Here's why. Because people who need an elevator,
yeah,
they probably need to transport things up a floor. An escalator is not going to help you do that. You need an elevator for it.
Jerry rig it.
Text message from an 817 says, thank you, Amy, for the hard-hitting Wyoming news. This is why KMOX won the Murrow. Thank you from Jeff in Tulsa. See, Jeff gets it.
I think I really struck a chord.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.